Fessenden was angry with the Navy for obtaining equipment outside the United States, and so did not submit a bid. Tesla was probably too upset with his treatment from the past and too involved with Wardenclyffe, which was under active construction at that time, to get involved, and so the Navy purchased additional sets from DeForest and Lodge Muirhead. In 1903, a mock battle with the North Atlantic Fleet was held 500 miles off the coast of Cape Cod. With the White Squadron, commanded by Rear Admiral J. H. Sands, and the Blue Squadron by Rear Admiral Higginson, Tesla's ally, the use of wireless played a key role in determining the victor. Commander Higginson, who won the maneuver, commented, "To me, the great lesson of the search we ended today is the absolute need of wireless in the ships of the Navy. You know we are 3 years behind the times in the adoption of wireless." Based on comparison testing, it was determined that the Schlabi Arco system outperformed all others, and the Navy ordered 20 more sets. Simultaneously, they purchased an 11-year lease on the Marconi patents. With the onset of World War I, the use of wireless became a necessity for organizing troop movements, surveillance, and intercontinental communication. While the country was still neutral, the Navy was able to continue their use of the German equipment, until sentiments began to shift irreversibly to the British side. Via the British Navy, Marconi had his transmitters positioned in Canada, Bermuda, Jamaica, Colombia, the Falkland Islands, North and South Africa, Ceylon, Australia, Singapore, and Hong Kong. His was a mighty operation. In the United States, the American Marconi Division, under the directorship of the politically powerful John Griggs, former governor of New Jersey and attorney general under President McKinley, had transmitters located in New York, Massachusetts, and Illinois. One key problem, however, was that the Marconi equipment was still using the outmoded spark gap method. In April 1917, the U.S. Navy completed the seizure of all wireless stations, including those of their allies, the British. At the same time, Marconi was in the process of purchasing the Alexanderson alternator, which was in essence a refinement of the Tesla oscillator. Simultaneously, the Armstrong feedback circuit was becoming an obvious necessity for any wireless instrumentation. However, the Armstrong invention created a judicial nightmare, not only because it used as its core the DeForest Audion, but also because DeForest's invention was overturned in the courts in favor of an electronic tube developed by Fessenden. Never mind that Tesla, as far back as 1902, had beaten Fessenden in the courts for this development. With the Fessenden patent now under the control of Marconi, the courts would come to rule that no one could use the Armstrong feedback circuit without the permission of the other players. The most important ruling concerning the true identity of the inventor of the radio became neatly sidestepped by the War Powers Act of President Wilson, calling for the suspension of all patent litigation during the time of the war. France had already recognized Tesla's priority by their High Court, and Germany recognized him by Schlabi's affirmations and Telefunken's decision to pay royalties. But in America, the land of Tesla's home, the government backed off and literally prevented the courts from sustaining a decision. The Marconi Syndicate, in touch with kings from two countries with equipment instituted on six continents, was simply too powerful. With the suspension of all patent litigation and the country in the midst of a world war, Franklin Roosevelt, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, penned the famous Farragut letter. This document allowed such major companies as AT&T, Westinghouse, and American Marconi the right to pool together to produce each other's equipment without concern for compensating rightful inventors. Furthermore, it assured contractors that the government would assume liability in infringement suits. On July 1, 1918, Congress passed a law making the United States financially responsible for any use of an invention described in and covered by a patent of the United States. By 1921, the U.S. government had spent $40 million on wireless equipment, a far cry from Secretary Long's policy of refusing to pay a few thousand dollars for Tesla's equipment 18 years before. Thus, the Interdepartmental Radio Board met to decide various claims against it. Nearly $3 million in claims were paid out. The big winners were Marconi Wireless, which received $1.2 million for equipment and installations taken over, but not for their patents. International Radio Telegraph received $700,000, AT&T $600,000, and Edwin Armstrong $89,000. Tesla received a minuscule compensation through Lowenstein, who was awarded $23,000. In 1921, the Navy published a list of all the inventors in wireless who received compensation from them. The list contained only patents granted after 1902. Inventors included Blockman, Brown, Blondell, DeForest, Fuller, Hahnemann, Logwood, Meissner, Randall, Paulson, Schiessler, von Arco, and Watkins. Note that both Tesla's and Marconi's names are missing. Marconi's could be missing either because his patents had lapsed, or, more likely, because they were viewed as invalid from the point of view of the government. In the case of Tesla, all of his 12 key radio patents had expired and were now common property. However, Tesla had renewed one fundamental patent in 1914, and this should have been on the list, as should have Armstrong's feedback patent. Radio Corporation of America. The U.S. government, through Franklin Roosevelt, knew that Marconi had infringed upon Tesla's fundamental patents. They knew the details of Tesla's rightful claims through their own files and through the record at the Patent Office. In point of fact, it was Tesla's proven declaration which was the basis and central argument that the government had against Marconi when Marconi sued in the first place, and it was this same claim and the same Navy Lighthouse Board files that would eventually be used by the U.S. Supreme Court to vindicate Tesla 3 months after he died, nearly 25 years later in 1943. Rather than deal with the truth and with a difficult genius whose present work appeared to be in a realm above and beyond the operation of simple radio telephones and wireless transmitters, Roosevelt, Daniels, President Wilson, and the U.S. Navy, in the midst of war, took no interest in protecting Tesla's tower. In July 1917, Tesla packed his bags and said goodbye to the Waldorf Astoria. Having lived there for nearly 20 years, he talked George Bolt Jr. into allowing him to keep a large part of his personal effects in the basement of the hotel until he found a suitable place for transferring them. "I was sorry to hear about your father," Tesla told the new manager, George Bolt Sr. having died just a few months before. Preparing to move to Chicago to work on his bladeless turbines, Tesla was invited to the Johnsons for a farewell dinner. Robert was now directing the affairs of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, an organization which counted among its ranks Daniel Chester French, Charles Dana Gibson, Winslow Homer, Henry James and his brother William, Charles McKim, Henry Cabot Lodge, Teddy Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson. Catherine had been in bed for over a week with the grippe, but this evening was too important, and she dragged herself out of bed and put on her best gown. Dressed in a straw hat, cane, white gloves, and his favorite green suede high tops, Tesla arrived with a large bouquet of flowers and a check for Johnson. "Kate's been ill," Robert managed to say before the lady of the house appeared. Taking center stage, as she always tried to do when he was around, Kate radiated an intense glow of amorous pride as she held back the flood of tears while she chatted on and on about how crazy she was about all of her grandchildren. Taking a weekend train to Chicago, Tesla moved into the Blackstone Hotel alongside the University of Chicago. On Monday morning, the inventor hired a limousine to drop him at the headquarters of Pyle National Corporation. Having already shipped prototypes to give them a head start, he would now work at an intense pace in an entirely new setting, his goal being the perfection of his revolutionary bladeless turbines. At night, he liked to walk down the street from his hotel to the Museum of Arts and Sciences, the only building remaining from the World's Fair of 1893. There, he could stand by the great columns and think back to a time when daily hundreds of thousands would stream into a magical city powered by his vision. One Saturday, in the heat of summer, he took the mile walk along Lake Michigan, past the Midway, to a series of small lakes and a park which was once the Court of Honor. There, at the entranceway to a place that once was, he found to his delight the statue of the Republic, still standing, its gold plating all worn away. With him was a letter from George Scherf. August 20th, 1917. Dear Mr. Tesla, I was deeply grieved and shocked when I read the enclosed, but I have the supreme confidence that more glorious work will arise from the ruins. I trust that your work in Chicago is progressing to your satisfaction. Yours respectfully, George Scherf. At the height of the world conflagration, the Smiley Steel Company's explosive expert had circled the gargantuan transmitter to place a charge around each major strut and nail the coffin shut on Tesla's dream. With the Associated Press recording the event and military personnel apparently present, the magnifying transmitter was leveled, the explosion alarming many of the Shoreham residents. And with the death of the World Telegraphy Center came the birth of the Radio Broadcasting Corporation, a unique conglomerate of private concerns under the auspices of the U.S. government. Meetings were held behind closed doors in Washington between President Wilson, who wanted America to gain radio supremacy, Navy Secretary Daniels, his assistant Franklin Roosevelt, and representatives from GE, American Marconi, AT&T, and the Westinghouse Corporation. The J.P. Morgan and Company on the board of directors, and the Marconi patents as the backbone of the organization, RCA was formed. It would combine resources from these mega corporations, all of which had cross-licensing agreements with each other and co-owned the company. Cross-licensing agreements also existed with the government, which also owned some wireless patents. Here was another entente cordiale reminiscent of the AC polyphase days, which was not so for the originator of the invention. It was a second major time Tesla would be carved from his creation, a secret deal probably concocted which absolved the government from paying any licensing fee to Marconi in lieu of their burying their Tesla archives. David Sarnoff, as managing director, would soon take over the reins of the entire operation. The New York Sun inaccurately reported, U.S. blows up Tesla radio tower. Suspecting that German spies were using the big wireless tower erected at Shoreham, Long Island, about 20 years ago by Nikola Tesla, the federal government ordered the tower destroyed, and it was recently demolished with dynamite. During the past month, several strangers had been seen lurking about the place. The destruction of Nikola Tesla's famous tower shows forcibly the great precautions being taken at this time to prevent any news of military importance of getting to the enemy. At the end of the war, President Wilson returned all remaining confiscated radio stations to their rightful owners. American Marconi, now RCA, of course, was the big beneficiary. In 1920, the Westinghouse Corporation was granted the right to manufacture, use, and sell apparatus covered by the Marconi patents. Westinghouse also formed an independent radio station, which became as prominent as RCA. At the end of the year, Tesla wrote a letter to E.M. Hare, president of the company, offering his wireless expertise and equipment. November 16, 1920. Dear Mr. Tesla, I regret that under the present circumstances we cannot proceed further with any developments of your activities. A few months later, Westinghouse requested that Tesla speak to our invisible audience some Thursday night in the near future over our radio telephone broadcasting station. November 30th, 1921. Gentlemen, 21 years ago, I promised a friend, the late J. Pierpont Morgan, that my world system, then under construction, would enable the voice of a telephone subscriber to be transmitted to any point of the globe. I prefer to wait until my project is completed before addressing an invisible audience, and beg you to excuse me. Very truly yours, N. Tesla. 42. Transmutation. 1918 to 1921. I come from a very wiry and long-lived race. Some of my ancestors have been centenarians, and one of them lived 129 years. I am determined to keep up the record and please myself with prospects of great promise. Then again, nature has given me a vivid imagination. Nikola Tesla. Tesla's life work was his World Telegraphy Center. Partially materialized on the physical plane as Wardenclyffe, this was the inventor's holy grail, the key to anointment. In 1917, the project was demolished and in that sense, so was the inventor. Capable of recognizing the absurdities of life and drawing from transcendent energies, the mystic sought regeneration by consummating his grand plan in fantasy form and by seeking a new philosopher's stone. 1 year earlier, when Tesla's project was at its bleakest, he had formed an alliance with one of his most ardent admirers, Hugo Gernsback, editor of Electrical Experimenter. Gernsback had first heard about Tesla when he was a child growing up in Luxembourg in the late 1890s. It was at this time that the 10-year-old came across the fantastic picture of the emblazoned electrician sending hundreds of thousands of volts through his body, and the declaration in the accompanying article that he was the grandest wizard of the age. Considered by most futurologists to be the founder and father of science fiction, Gernsback studied electronics at Bingen Technikum in Europe before immigrating to America at the age of 19 in 1903. With his mind totally captivated by the fantastic union of science and fantasy, the exuberant youth wrote a spectacular tale which took place in the year 2660, called Ralph 124C41+, which he serialized in his new magazine, Modern Electronics. Simultaneously, he also opened up Hugo Gernsback's Electro Importing Company, an all-purpose electronics shop located under the L at Fulton Street. There, the new breed of amateur ham operators could buy whatever they wanted and browse through the biggest bunch of junk you ever saw. Gernsback's first meeting with Tesla was in 1908, when he stopped at the inventor's lab to view the new turbine. Gernsback wrote, "The door opens, and out steps a tall figure, over 6 feet high, gaunt but erect. It approaches slowly, stately. You become conscious at once that you are face to face with a personality of high order. Nikola Tesla advances and shakes your hand with a powerful grip, surprising for a man over 60. A winning smile from piercing light blue-gray eyes set in extraordinary deep sockets fascinates you and makes you feel at once at home. You are guided into an office immaculate in its orderliness. Not a speck of dust is to be seen. No papers litter the desk. Everything just so. It reflects the man himself, immaculate in attire, orderly and precise in his every movement. Dressed in a dark frock coat, he is entirely devoid of all jewelry. No ring, stickpin, or even watch chain can be seen." In 1916, the inventor edited a consequential article for Gernsback on the magnifying transmitter. The inventor also promised to think more seriously about putting his life story down on paper. In fact, he wrote a short first draft for Scientific American, which he embellished for the Edison Medal acceptance speech. By this time, Gernsback had also secured the talents of the gifted illustrator Frank R. Paul. Destined to be the most influential science fiction artist of the 20th century, Paul was able to render the possible development of any invention from a raw idea into a picture fantasy. With a penchant for drawing futuristic scenarios such as Goliath-sized insects, spaceships orbiting planets, and a variety of humanoidian mad scientists conquering galactic empires, Paul advanced to become the premier cover artist for Electrical Experimenter and later Amazing Stories and Science Wonder Stories. He was assigned the role of completing Tesla's tower in picture form. The drawing, replete with fully functioning Wardenclyffe transmitters and Tesla wingless airfoils beaming down death rays to incoming ships, not only became a fantastic cover for Electrical Experimenter, it also became the centerpiece of the wizard's new letterhead. As alchemist, Tesla transformed the ruins of his station into a fantastic Gernsbackian world telegraphy center, as he also transformed himself, leaving New York City to begin anew with his next major creation. Before he left in June 1917, the inventor wrote Jack Morgan, hoping, optimistically, because of new developments, to pay off his debt to the financier, in about 4 months. "My big ship is still to come in, but I have now a marvelous opportunity, having perfected an invention which will astound the whole world." Cryptically, Tesla said that the invention would afford an effective means for meeting the menaces of the submarine. Whether he was talking about a long-range radar system, a remote-controlled torpedo, or some other invention, is uncertain. The following month, Tesla moved to Chicago, and he stayed there through November 1918, working with Pi National on the perfection of his turbines. Here, during the day, with the slate clean, the gangly mechanic could continue to battle the demons by plunging himself into a brand new endeavor. At night, as creative author, the cognoscenti sketched out the first draft of his expanded autobiography. Most of the time, he drew from his own capital, for fear of causing difficulties with the new partners. He knew he would eventually receive compensation, because the Chicago company had signed an agreement promising cash payments and guarantees with the expiration of their option. But carrying costs were becoming a problem. To handle expenses in the interim, the inventor requested that Scherf step up the pressure on receiving royalties from the various wireless companies. His greatest source of income was probably the Waltham Watch Company, which was now in the active stage of marketing his speedometer. Even though the war was still going on, the inventor expected to receive compensation from Telefunken after the hostilities cease, even though he would have to apply to the War Trade Board under the Trading with the Enemy Act for a license to receive payment. Progress on the turbines was hampered by numerous obstacles. Nevertheless, the inventor was delighted with the extraordinarily efficient personnel and overall organization of the Chicago firm. As the disks could rotate at speeds ranging from 10,000 to 35,000 RPM, the centrifugal force tended to elongate them. Thus, they were subject to fatigue and ran the risk of cracking after performing for long periods of time. Perceived by skeptical engineers as fatal flaws, Tesla endeavored to hammer home the point that stress was a factor in all engines. Thus, much of the time in Chicago was spent experimenting with different alloys and inventing means for instantaneously regulating orthorotational speed and centrifugal pressure to minimize the stress factor. For instance, suppose that the steam pressure of the locomotive would vary from, say, 50 to 200 pounds, no matter how rapidly. This would not have the slightest effect on the performance of the turbine. In January 1918, the U.S. Machine Manufacturing Company inquired about placing one of Tesla's turbines inside an airplane, and a few months later the Chicago Pneumatic Tool Company also expressed interest. Tesla was writing Scherf expecting the invention to yield $25 million per year. However, there was still the difficulty of perfecting it, and Tesla was still not free of the numerous other problems of his life, such as the past debts and the continuing quagmire of litigation. During the summer, the inventor twisted his back and was laid up for several weeks. During Tesla's time in Chicago, he calculated his operating expenses at $17,600, with revenues of $12,500. Pyle National tried to get out of their debt by sending a check for $1,500, but Tesla returned the token payment and threatened suit. Meanwhile, back at home, the sheriff took possession of the Woolworth office, so Tesla had to wrestle some capital from Pyle National to release his company. In New York, George Scherf continued to handle all of the details. Concerning his relationship with the government, as stated in Chapter 41, most of Tesla's wireless patents had expired, and his 1914 patent was complicated by its clash with the Marconi claim. However, he was negotiating with the government on an engine for a plane, writing to the Bureau of Steam Engineering at this time. In litigation, Tesla won a few thousand dollars from Lowenstein, lost a $67,000 case against a Mr. de la Verne, in part because he refused to travel back to New York to testify, and had to pay out $1,600 to A.M. Foster for non-payment of services rendered. Before returning to Manhattan for the last months of 1918, the inventor traveled to Milwaukee to visit the Alice Chalmers people. There he was met by the astute but pedantic head engineer, Hans Dahlstrandt. After providing various articles and records from his work at the Edison Station and Pyle National, a contract was drawn up for Tesla to return to Milwaukee and develop the engine with Dahlstrandt. Skeptical from the start, the learned head engineer reluctantly agreed to defer to Tesla's wishes and begin a preparatory investigation of the turbine before he arrived. Throughout this period, 1917 to 1926, the inventor spent most of his time outside New York City. In the years 1917 to 1918, he was in Chicago with Pyle National. In 1919 to 1922, he was in Milwaukee with Alice Chalmers. For the last month of 1922, he was in Boston with the Waltham Watch Company, and in the years 1925 to 1926, he was in Philadelphia working on the gasoline turbine at Budd Manufacturing Company. Tesla also sold a motor which was used in motion picture equipment to Wisconsin Electric in 1918, and a valvular conduit or unidirectional fluid flow tube to an unspecified oil company. This last invention, which can also be called a fluid diode, could not only be used to pump oil from the ground, but also be attached to the bladeless turbine to turn it into a combustion engine. According to Tesla expert Leyland Anderson, this invention is the only valving patent without moving parts. It has been used in attempts to develop micro-miniature radiation-hardened logic circuits and simple fluid computers. Waltham speedometers and automobile clocks. Every progressive automobile manufacturer is adding improvements to his car. This is why the only air friction speedometer in the world, invented by Nikola Tesla, perfected and developed by Waltham, has won the unqualified approval of the world's great automotive engineers. You will find this instrument upon such cars as the Cunningham, Lafayette, Leach Biltwell, Lincoln, Packard, Pierce Arrow, Renault, Rolls-Royce, Stevens Dourier, Wills St. Clair, and others. The speedometer of instantaneous accuracy. The inventor arrived at the Copley Plaza in Boston to negotiate with Mr. May, the manager of the factory, the advance and royalty schedule. Concerning revenues, Tesla received $5,000 from Waltham, assigning them three of his patents in 1922 for a speedometer and tachometer. This agreement included royalties, which he received until at least 1929. Pyle National eventually paid him $15,000 and maybe $30,000 in 1925. From Budd National, he received $30,000 for the turbines, and probably a similar amount from Alice Chalmers, from whom he was expecting profits on the order of $250,000 per year. George Scherf received 5% from most of these contracts. Tesla arrived back home at the tail end of 1918 in time for Christmas dinner with the Johnsons. He stayed for a brief time at the Waldorf and then moved to the Hotel St. Regis, where he lived off and on for the next few years. The great influenza epidemic was just in its beginning stages, and Catherine was one of the first to display signs of its ravages. In the next year, over 1 billion people were infected, and 20 million died worldwide. She was lucky to survive. Her health deteriorated throughout the year, and by the following Christmas, she experienced episodes during which she lost consciousness 3 times within a single day. Perhaps heightened by the severity of the situation, and with new income from Waltham, Tesla paid Robert checks totaling at least $1,500 during this period. Throughout 1919, Tesla's autobiography appeared in serialized form in Gernsback's Electrical Experimenter. Paired with photographs and a series of spectacular Frank Paul drawings, the story began as an unusual tale of a wizard child growing up in another era in a faraway land. The account of the early years of Tesla's life oozed charm and wit, with its numerous Mark Twainian depictions of amusing anecdotes, harrowing experiences, life with his inventive mother, preacher father, prodigal brother, and 3 doting sisters. Digging deep into his past, Tesla explored the tragedy of his brother's death, how it impacted his career decision, the traumatic move away from the idyllic farm to the clutter of Gospich, his college years, engineering training in Europe before coming to America, and his early meetings with Edison, Westinghouse, and members of the Royal Society of London. Also included was an uncommon description of his peculiar powers of eidetic imagery, out-of-body experiences, childhood illnesses, phobias, and idiosyncrasies. In month after month of fascinating reading, the pundit detailed the development of his ideas, his physical breakdown, and opening up of the third eye experience and accompanying revelation, which led to the development of the rotating magnetic field, his creation of the teleautomaton, work in Colorado Springs, and the grand Wardenclyffe World Wireless design. This liaison with Gernsback supplied the inventor with a steady income, and helped Electrical Experimenter boost its circulation to around 100,000. Simultaneously,